Hello and welcome to Grierson and Leach Conversations. We are delighted to have Grierson is here, by the way. It's not just going to be
I am here. I can actually see Will. I usually don't see Will when we do the podcast. This is a very, very weird experience. You're not usually in the room that you are right now, Will.
This is the only place I can trust the wireless is down here. Sad little corner. We're delighted to have on as our guest. The minute this book came out, I was so thrilled. I knew we didn't have to have him on the show to say the very least. I figured, what are we even doing this show if we don't have Matt Singer on talking about this? Matt Singer is not only the only person currently on this podcast that can successfully grow a beard, he is also the author of Opposable Thumbs: How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever. Matt is also, of course, the main critic and writer for Screen Crush, one of those critics who I have talked before about the critics that we always, after we see a movie, we've secured what we're doing, the people that we make sure to read, all the people we always go to make sure and read. Grierson, not among those people.
Rude. He's a hurtful person.
But Matt is one of those people. Matt, thank you for coming on and talking to us. How's it going?
It's going very well. I think I need to get a better resolution camera. If you think this beard looks good, then I need to upgrade the camera because it looks horrible and I just didn't have time to shave
today. I didn't say good. I just said you could grow one and we can.
Yeah. Well, I think that is a compliment I don't think I've earned because there's spots where I can't. It's really embarrassing.
You still grow a better beard than Will and I do. So take the compliment. Mostly it's an insult to me and Will because we cannot grow facial hairs.
If I don't shave for like 3 weeks, I look vaguely Skeet Ulrichy. That's like the best I can do. In that regard. Okay. First off, Matt, thank you for coming on. I love the book. I have told you privately. I don't know why I would use the term privately as if we are, as if we were in a John Le Carre-esque room of silence. There are times I've felt reading this book that you had written it specifically for me. But its success is proof that that's not true because there are other people that are out enjoying this and reading as well. I wrote my newsletter about this week about kind of what it felt like to watch Siskel and Ebert to discover Siskel and Ebert. I would say Ebert is a kind of a driving influence in both in my life and I think Grierson's as well. And how much the show for us kind of like was a portal to an outside world. Before we get into the details of the book, I'm curious your initial experiences with your first time you watched Siskel and Ebert. I know you eventually would work with Ebert a little bit, but you're around our age. What was it like the first time you kind of saw it and what your discovery of the show?
I don't remember the first time. That's one of the weirdest things about this is that I've been asked that, like, how did you discover the show? I have no idea how I found Siskel and Ebert, which is very odd because it couldn't have been that long between discovering it and what I do remember, which is, being 12, 13 years old and being totally obsessed with Siskel and Ebert. And, this was not an easy show to watch, at least for me growing up in suburban New Jersey. It had terrible time slots. It was on in syndication and they would move it seemingly at random, seemingly without warning. You would tune in at the time you thought it was going to be on, that it had been on the previous week, only to discover it was not on anymore. And if I had started watching it maybe at, Saturday nights at 7 p.m. or something like that, before too long, it had migrated to Sunday nights, and then it kept getting pushed later and later and, 11 o'clock, 11:30, 12 o'clock. And I'm 12, I'm 13 years old, and I'm not, I am not allowed to stay up that late on a weekend, much less on a school night. Yeah. So what I remember in terms of my early memories is, the rigorous scheming that I would have to create to get around my parents, having to go to bed and saying good, I would pretend to go to sleep. And it's in the acknowledgments of the book. It's totally true. I would lie to my parents. Something I was not like a kid who did a lot of bad stuff. It wasn't like I was regularly making up lies to my parents and then, sneaking out of my room or, doing drugs. Like my big lie was watching Siskel and Ebert at midnight. And I would say, I would say goodnight. I would go to bed. I would just lay in the dark and stay awake and just wait, watch the clock. And then at 11:59 or whatever it was, maybe 12:29 later, if it kept getting pushed back, I would then turn the TV back on in my room and just hope that didn't get too loud. And that's what I remember is I remember it being this like secret, this illicit thing that I was doing. I was walking on the wild side with Gene and Roger.
Well, I just love that, you know, I'm sneaking around watching Dream On about that same age.
I probably did that too, but I guess we don't talk about that as much, you know.
Well, that's your next book.
That's the next book.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny.
Where has Ben been these days? I hope he's alive.
Anyway. Because it's funny because I was actually thinking the same thing in terms of like how I started watching Siskel and Ebert. It's kind of the same way where I don't remember it not existing in my world. And then it just started existing and I just started watching it. It wasn't a thing. Obviously, Will and I have known each other for a long time, but there was no moment of either one of us saying to the other, hey, have you checked out these Siskel and Ebert cats? Like there was nothing like that. It was just, I was watching it. I think, Will, you were watching it. And I don't know if my parents, because I liked movies, but I didn't have that aha moment either. It was just, I just remember watching it all the time. And, you know, we grew up downstate Illinois, about 3 hours from Chicago. And it moved around a little bit, but I can't remember it quite as much as the experience that you had.
I think
had
it just depended if there was a football game on WAND.
If it was preempted or whatever. Yeah. But, you know, we haven't talked about this, Matt, but I really, really love the book too. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, among other things, is while you're writing the book, I don't know if this was an initial proposal with an agent or a publisher, or if this kind of came to you as you're writing the book. I was really interested in the subtitle, which is, you know, as Will said, it's How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever. But I also thought you could also do a subtitle, which is How If Siskel and Ebert Changed Film Criticism Forever. One of the things I love about the book is that if you're a Siskel and Ebert fan, the book is fantastic in terms of the details. I'm somebody who really, really, really loved Siskel and Ebert. I learned a ton from reading the book, and I've read oral histories. I watched Life Itself, the documentary, but there's a ton of stuff that you got, and kudos to you in terms of all the cool stuff you found. But to me, the book is also this like paying to film criticism itself and why it matters. And while I was reading the book, and of course, I know, Matt, how much you care about film criticism, I couldn't help but think Matt really loves Siskel and Ebert, but he really cares about film criticism and why it matters and why it's important. And that is, to me, just as important in terms of what the book is talking about and what it's wrestling with. And I was curious, did you always know that from the beginning, that it would be about these two guys, but also just sort of about film criticism itself and why it still matters?
I always did want that to be part of it. And thank you for the lovely things you said. But it was primarily because, you know, yes, like Siskel and Ebert, they're very funny and they could be so mean to each other and like it's entertaining to watch them fight, but they 100% are the reason I do this. And so for me, you know, I wasn't even that big of a movie fan. And when I'm describing like 12-year-old me becoming obsessed with the show, that's when I became obsessed with movies. Before that, I went to the movies, I watched movies, but I was not like, you know, Dad, I want to go see the new whatever art house movie. You have to drive me 45 minutes to the only art house in New Jersey to go see this. That was not who I was. That's who I became as a result of watching Siskel and Ebert. It flowed in that direction. It wasn't, I like movies, and so then I must watch Siskel and Ebert. It was, I found the show somehow and became fascinated with it, and then through the show, discovered film and film criticism. So yes, to me, I and thankfully my Putnam, the publisher of the book, and my editor there, Michelle, like they got that vision right away. It's like, yes, we're gonna tell all the juicy backstage stories, we're gonna give you every possible hilarious Gene and Roger fighting anecdote you could possibly want. But we are also going to try to make it a book about the history of film criticism and how they fit into that, and why they are important. And the one part of the book, kind of to your question, that I did not originally conceive, but was completely done to further that side of the book, was the appendix, which is these 25 kind of less famous titles that they loved. And that was, again, it was me. I'm watching hundreds of episodes of the show. I'm taking all these notes. And sure, I expected when I'm doing this that there's going to be movies I've never heard of course. But I assumed most of them would be, you know, 2.5, 2-star movies that nobody has ever heard of and nobody cares about. And they've fallen down a memory hole. And of course, no one remembers them. And what surprised me was how many movies they gave 2 thumbs up to. They sometimes appeared on their top 10 lists, or they would mention them multiple times as home video picks or whatever it was. And I've never seen a lot of these movies and never even heard of a few of them. And after a while of watching and watching and watching and taking ridiculous amounts of notes, I realized maybe there was a way to do kind of like an old Ebert guide, the movie home companion, or even a Maltin guide, which of course I loved those as a kid as well, and put a little more film criticism / film advocacy in there by doing this appendix of movies that they loved that are kind of buried treasures was the name of the episodes as they first did them on the show. They would do buried treasure episodes where they would recommend movies that at the time you probably couldn't even see them on VHS because VHS did not really exist yet. But that, you know, I guess they were hoping people, maybe they would get a second run in theaters, or maybe they would play on television or something. Movies to seek out that had flopped in theaters. And so I kind of borrowed that name and made it the appendix where you get 25 movies from throughout the history of the show. And I tried to make it all different kinds of genres and styles of movies and from different countries. And there's documentaries. And I tried to give a nice survey of a variety of kinds of movies that are all those sorts of little movies that are great, but not considered classics for whatever reason. And that was something that came later during the research that also was, it's Siskel and Ebert. Like, we got to figure out a way to get some film criticism into this book. So that was another one of the ways that I did that.
One of the things I find myself looking back at the show now, I feel very fortunate because, like, when I discovered the show, obviously I was into the things that we're all talking about, but I actually could not have possibly realized that, like, these are actually two of the best film critics that were working at the time. Like, I feel like, you know, I feel like when you discover things, you don't know because you're new to it. You don't know yet that, like, oh, this could be just some hack that's selling crap for me. Then they not only did they have this deep love for movies, but they really knew what they were talking about and had that kind of passion about it. And I was thinking, there's a great moment that I remembered from years ago about how there was a kerfuffle over, it was not actually when they reviewed The Crying Game. It was when they talked about their end of the year show where the big secret that everyone was worried about, the Siskel revealed it and Ebert got furious, and to the point that it became an actual national news story. And you have this great quote from Siskel saying that there would be no fighting because we're physically incapable of doing it, whatever. He said it funnier than I did. But the idea, there's like several incredible things about that. The idea that a fight between them would make national news. B, that they'd be talking about this quiet, independent movie about an Irish soldier having an affair, discovering that he's in love with a transgender singer. The fact that that movie would be a big part of a discussion. The fact that that movie would be the central discussion of a nationally syndicated program that was shown all around the country. And I think that speaks to one of the things that I was reminded. There's so many good parts of the book, but I found myself, my favorite parts were like being reminded, oh, right, they did a whole half hour show on Hoop Dreams. They did a whole half hour show. Like, they would launch the show like, hey, everybody, here's this Neil Jordan Irish movie that none of you know about, but you have to know about it. And it feels like in an age now where everything is like, I understand we're going to talk about the Marvel movie this weekend. You just wrote about the Marvel movie. Everything is funneled in that direction. But there's a certain kind of confidence and almost reporters insistence, like, no, this is the biggest story of the week, and no matter what is going to sell the best, whatever the biggest thing is, we're telling you about this movie because it's the best movie of the week. That would, to me, what was so exciting was going back and discovering, shit, man, like, they just like, they like, they didn't like, they would do the big releases of the week, but a lot of ways they felt a certain obligation to talk about the great stuff. When you kind of researched it, were there struggles between them and their producers being like, seriously, you need to only talk about Jurassic Park 3 right now? Or like, was that a fight that they had, or did they have people with them from the get-go on that?
That it did come up occasionally. People would say to me, you know, I spoke to a lot of different producers and directors who worked on the show throughout the years. And sometimes they would get some pushback about, well, we should be covering the movies that are people can see right now in a theater near them. And sometimes, you know, to your point, like some of these littler movies, you know, they might be playing in New York and LA and that's it. And, you know, their audience all over the country in this nationally syndicated show, including maybe in Chicago in some cases, is not going to be able to see this movie while they're talking about it. But I think that their rebuttal to that was, well, but by talking about it and using our platform and telling people they need to see it, that gets the word out. That gets the audience to demand their local art house theater to show it or demand their video store to buy copies of that movie when it does come out on home video. That they recognized the power that they had by the time the show got big is that they did have this enormous voice and platform that they could use to support littler movies, and that they would often say in interviews, Gene and Roger would say, like, that's the best part of the show is when you can tell people to go see this tiny little movie that they otherwise probably would not have heard of, much less seen. And then they go and then the movie turns into a hit and they can say, we did something good. They talked about that at the time in interviews, you know, during the late 80s, early 90s. That was something that definitely came up. And I was talking to somebody in the last week or two, and they had a similar reaction to what you said, Will. And I thought it was a very well put. They were like, we were lucky that Siskel and Ebert were Siskel and Ebert. Yeah. That, to your point, like, they could have been, you know, just like fame whores. They could have right. just been in it to be schmoozing with celebrities and directors. And look, I'm sure they did. They enjoyed going on talk shows and, you know, all of the stuff that comes with being Siskel and Ebert, but they didn't lose sight of that element. And when they would be asked about why do the show still, what's the best part of the show, time and again, that was what they said, was the ability to wield that whatever cachet they had to point people in the right direction, to funnel people to the movies that needed their support. And somebody else I did this great event recently in Columbus, Ohio at the Drexel Theater, this amazing little art house theater that's been there 100 years. And we had like a full house. People just came to hear me talk about Siskel and Ebert. It's ludicrous, but they did. And someone asked a similar question, which was like, did they ever get worried doing, because they did do so many talk shows and appearances, and did they ever worry that they were getting too big or too famous, or, you know, that they were getting too far from their core mission? And I certainly don't know of any quotes where they said that they did. And to me, the whole point of doing those shows, besides the fact that I'm sure it was enjoyable to go on David Letterman, I mean, who wouldn't want to go on David Letterman, was the more eyeballs on them on those shows, the more eyeballs on Siskel and Ebert, and the more power they had to tell people, go see Hoop Dreams, go see My Dinner with Andre, go see Gates of Heaven, go see one of the 25 movies that's in the back of my book, you know. And they took that responsibility seriously, and I think they used it pretty well. And so, yes, I think we were really lucky that they were the guys who had that platform. Now you could say, well, two other schmoes who didn't care about movies, it wouldn't have worked, it wouldn't have lasted, and maybe that's true too, but I agree with you. They were the right guys for that job. And yeah, they understood the importance of that job, and the, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, to cribble a line from another book I've written about. They understood that, and they definitely applied the show and their power that way.
You know, this is not my next question, but just as a side note, you're talking about the other schmoes who could have done it and didn't do a good job. I thought you were extremely fair, Matt, in terms of talking to other people who had done competing shows and talking to them about why they didn't work and like that. I just thought it's really nicely done. And as somebody who, I'm not considering Christy and Ignati in terms of what I'm talking about, but also hearing from them, I thought it was really, I mean, I know Christy really well, but to hear from both of them about the weirdness of trying to follow in their shadow, I thought was it's a side thing. I just wanted to say, I really, really loved how you handled that. But the thing I wanted to ask you was, because Ebert lived longer and had this whole sort of second act, if you will, after Siskel died, I think we think about people who are our age think about Ebert in a different way than we think about Siskel. And I think especially for younger film fans and film critics, they think about Ebert very differently than they do Siskel. I was curious for you in terms of writing the book, did you feel in any way that you wanted to give Siskel his due? Not that Ebert doesn't deserve his due, but in a lot of ways, partly because of the documentary, partly because there is still a website devoted to him and people who write, for, you know, did you feel like I kind of have to stick up for Siskel a little bit because he may have been somewhat forgotten over the years?
I didn't necessarily, here's how I looked at it. And I think it's a very good question. And I do agree that Ebert has the benefit of that second act or third act, however you want to call it.
Yeah.
And I absolutely think, I mean, for me personally, I thought about my own opinion of him evolved over that time. I mean, I was a huge fan of the show, but in the early days, it wasn't like I was like, well, this is Roger Ebert's show and Gene Siskel is there. I thought they were, I just thought about them as Siskel and Ebert together. And it really was after Siskel passes away. You guys were lucky to grow up where you did in terms of, I'm guessing you could probably read his reviews a lot more easily than I could in New Jersey.
Yeah.
I didn't start reading his reviews weekly until college when the Sun-Times website started posting them every single Friday. Then it became a ritual that every Friday, me and my movie nerd pals on Friday afternoons when we came back from classes, we would read every review he had published, and then we would kind of talk about them. What did you think of this one? That was pretty interesting things. He had, you know, like that was a routine and a ritual that we did, but that came later. And then, of course, all of his books that he started publishing around that time, the Great Movies series, and it absolutely made me think of him in even much larger terms than I already had just being a fan of the show. But the way that I approached it was, even as much as I did want to give Siskel his due, I did not want the book to be too tilted one way or the other, because I could just almost envision if they had been able to read this book, I would never want to speculate what they would think about it. But I feel confident saying that if the book felt tilted in either direction too much, that would have not been acceptable to either of them. Right. Because one thing I can say with great certainty is how obsessively focused they were on that in every aspect of their lives that was joined together, that everything had to be fair and even. And if it wasn't, they were going to raise a stink about it. And so I was very focused on making sure the book was not tilted one way or the other too much. And that kind of came out in, you know, I don't know that I actually I didn't necessarily count the words like to the word, but I wanted the chapter about each of them to be basically the same length. I did not want one to be longer than the other. And I would try my best to kind of make sure that there were quotes from both of them and that I wasn't relying too heavily on quotes from Siskel or from Ebert, that I would want them both to be represented equally as much as possible. So that was how that was expressed, was I wanted this to be the Siskel and Ebert book. Obviously, Roger wrote a memoir. It's a wonderful memoir. And he's written so many other things. And I suppose, you know, there may still be a Gene Siskel book out there for someone who wanted to write one. And I actually think it's possible to me that such a thing could exist. And I would read it. I didn't want this to be the Gene Siskel book. This to me was the Siskel and Ebert book. And I did my darndest to make it that and make it even. And I tried my best. If they would have looked at it and disagreed, and perhaps they would have. All I could say was I was cognizant of it and I tried. I really tried to make it evenly balanced between the two as best as I could.
You'll find out when you're at the gates of St. Peter's and they're each waiting there going.
When the thumbs are going up or down, perhaps.
Siskel's letting you know that you were too hard on him. I kind of love this idea. You know, they famously, one of the things that was interesting about them is they got kind of so famous that they would often sometimes be more famous, not just in the movies, but even some of the actors themselves. And they would end up, there are a lot of parodies for years and years and years, from In Living Color to famously Mayor Ebert in Godzilla. And even like more kind of more caustic stuff, like Vincent Gallo's thing with Ebert late in life. And I'm curious to remark that to now. I wrote about this in my newsletter last weekend, the idea that it does seem as criticism, and not just movie criticism, but as criticism in general has gotten, as either got filtered into the Rotten Tomatoes, or more to the point, just seen as hating or haters or so on. Like celebrities in a lot of ways and actors, they see criticism as like something to shut out and the haters to hate. There was no, but like a lot of times, like it would mean something. I saw an interview with Billy Crystal one time where he like joked about Siskel and Ebert several times about who are these guys and so on. And I wonder if there was value that you found in kind of researching of how the industry saw Siskel and Ebert and the idea, not just them as personalities, and not just them as like power, how much you needed the two thumbs up or you dread the two thumbs down, but the idea that they became such big things. You've interviewed enough celebrities and actors and directors and so on. We both have as well. Some handle criticism well, some don't handle it well. I think there's a quote from Robert Altman in there, who is friends with Ebert, saying, I can't just like the good reviews and not like the bad reviews. But I'm curious, what was it like? Were they aware of that? Forget chumming up with people, but how much power they had, and how when they'd interview an actor, in a lot of ways, Ebert might have been on Letterman more recently than they had been on Letterman.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they were amongst his most frequent guests. So yeah, that's probably true. That's almost, in most cases, it's almost definitely true that they were on more recently than whoever they were talking to. It's that's a big kind of topic. It's like, how much did they like that aspect of it? How did they wield it? How did they react to being celebrities at different points? Based on, again, I'm looking at all the interviews that I found with them, the research I did. Sometimes they seem to love it. Sometimes they seem less enamored with that side of things. You know, I was told by, you know, people who worked with them, they didn't like traveling together because they got recognized a lot more easily when they were hanging out together. You know, separately, they're just a guy from the Midwest in a V-neck sweater together. Instantly, they become, you know, there they are. That's them, you know. And, you know, they hated when they would be called by the wrong name, you know, because no one ever called them by the correct name. You know, Ebert was always Siskel. Siskel was always Ebert, vice versa. So it's interesting to think about that side of it, that they did become as big or bigger than a lot of the people they were talking about. I think, again, back to what we had kind of said before, I think that predominantly they saw the kind of the practical reality of it, that if they could use that to their advantage to get people to see the movies they liked, then that was a good thing, that it was like a net positive. They also at times were wary and like, you know, they never, for example, like they could have, and they were offered like commercials, they could have sold out. And I think probably these days, someone mm-hmm. in their position would have sold out. It's funny, like the idea of selling out barely even exists now. Now, the Siskel and if there was a Siskel and Ebert now, they would be selling, I don't know, foam finger thumbs or something. There would be a merchandise machine around it. And they, you know, turned down offers for real commercials. They, you know, supposedly were offered $1 million each, as the story goes anyway, $1 million each to do Apple, like an early Macintosh computer ad. And Ebert loved Macs his whole life. He was, you know, one of the most, you know, vocal proponents of Macs for as long as Macs were around. So it wasn't like a kind of thing where he would be selling out to the extent of, well, I'm going to say I like this thing and I don't like it. He did like it. He used them anyway, and they weren't paying him. But they felt, they decided together as a team that it would have maybe tarnished their legitimacy and their reputation and would have maybe made it seem more suspect when they did tell people, you need to go see Hoop Dreams or Gates of Heaven or whatever movie it is, that maybe people would have thought, well, they're getting paid by Apple, maybe they're getting paid by these people. You know, it would have perhaps set this precedent or would have created an image that they were very leery of. So they never did it. Like I said, now I wonder today, because you just see today, like nobody even thinks about quote unquote selling out. You know what I mean? It doesn't, that the concept has no meaning anymore, but back then it did. And they turned down a lot of money that they could have made in the world of commercials to kind of maintain what they felt was their reputation, their critical reputation.
One of the other things I really love about the book is that you actually wrestle with the criticisms that people, other critics had about them being on television, the thumbs up, thumbs down. And I really love, Matt, that you talk about it, dissect it, make the argument sort of for Siskel and Ebert. One of the things I was interested in that's not in the book, and I was curious about your thoughts about, a long time ago, Jonathan Rosenbaum wrote a piece about, I don't know if you ever read it, but talking about like the problem of film criticism on television. And one of the arguments that he made is like, okay, Roger Ebert is a guy who's won a Pulitzer, who goes to a ton of film festivals all around the world, sees all of these movies. Gene Siskel basically stays at home, doesn't travel nearly as much, doesn't see as much stuff as Roger does, who really kind of covers the cinematic waterfront. But on television, this was his argument, but on television, you wouldn't know the difference between the two of them because they're presented on television in some ways flattens the experiences that Roger's had going to all these festivals and going to all these movies. I've thought about that for a long time in terms of like, because he wrote years and years ago, that criticism. I'm curious how you feel about that in terms of them being on television, because I confess when I watched them on television, kind of like you guys were saying, I didn't know one guy was this and one guy was that. They were just two dudes who argued on television every week about movies. It's only as I got older that I realized sort of the distinctions in terms of how they approach criticism, how many movies they saw, etc. You wrote the book on this. I'm curious, how do you feel about the TVization of the two of them in terms of how they got their points across as critics?
Okay, first of all, I think Jonathan Rosenbaum is an awesome critic who I love reading. So this is not a knock against him. Anything I say to rebut that, I want to say, first of all, I think I have read that, but it, you know, like I didn't write about it in the book. I guess and I would say if you watch hundreds of episodes, which oddly enough, I think is actually kind of a really fun thing to do.
I mean, understand
the perspective of who is saying this, but like some people are like, was it hard watching hundreds of episodes of Siskel? I was like, it was the best thing ever. It was the greatest. I gave myself the excuse to watch every episode. It was amazing. I loved it. It was the best part of the whole thing. So, but when you do go look at it again, and I agree with you, Tim, that like when I was a kid, I didn't notice this, but when you go back and look, they do talk sometimes about how Gene hates going to film festivals. Roger loves going to film festivals. You know, there's episodes where there's like dispatches from Sundance or from Cannes by the 1990s. So it did come up. I see Rosenbaum's point about that. Yes, on TV, that wasn't certainly present in every episode or constantly. And the show worked best if they seemed, whether they were or not, in his opinion or anyone's opinion, it worked best if they seemed like equals, because then it was a fair fight. And that was where the tension came from, was that These two guys were on even footing and they were going to go at it and no one had the advantage. And if they had in the minds of the viewers, then the show doesn't work as well because it's not as exciting and interesting. So I get all of that. I think to me, what I came around to in terms of the TV side of the show, again, going back now and looking at it, was I came to realize, like, you know, so much of what they did, especially in the early days of the show when nobody was doing what they were doing in terms of clips at that point, was they were essentially inventing a new form of criticism that now we recognize as like video essays on YouTube, because they could illustrate their points with clips from movies, something that the greatest print critic in the world cannot do. And as the three of us here who have written many print reviews can tell you, that's one of the hard parts of the job, is to try to describe what's happening on film, on screen, with words that people who have not seen the film are trying to understand, or even after they've seen it, you're trying to capture what they've seen. Jonathan Rosenbaum is a great critic and he does that better than most, but it's very difficult to do. And I do think there is something really valuable. It's a different thing in a way, but there's something really valuable about the way that Siskel and Ebert honed that style, which was to say, like, the cinematography in this movie is magnificent. Let's look at this scene and watch the way that they place the camera, or look at how the camera is looking at this actor. Or they did a whole special episode on like black and white photography in movies and why black and white is, in their opinion, was better than color. And they showed you clips and they explained why they thought it was better. And they illustrated it with examples. That's hard to, that you cannot do that in print, or certainly not to the same extent. So I take his point, and I don't think it's invalid, but it's sort of a, you gain, you lose. It's like, yes, there's certain elements of the format that are weaknesses. Also, the reviews are shorter for the most part, because, you know, they're doing four reviews in 30 minutes. But when they chose to go longer, or they were able to get the clips that they really wanted, or they did, they could really, like, really make a point. And there's a few examples in the book that I tried to include where they could eviscerate a movie, you know, like, or make an argument about a movie in a matter of seconds and show you the clip. And you're kind of like, yeah, there you go. You know, I think it's a very complicated subject and very long-winded answer. But again, getting back to what you asked, like, I did try to address that in the book because there were a lot of people who did not like Siskel and Ebert. And so I did want to at least explore that and acknowledge it and think about it as part of the book.
I have to say also, I love that you mentioned the black and white episode in the book, Matt, because I remember watching that episode and thinking, oh my God, this whole thing is in black and white and they're dressed up. I completely remember that. That might have been when I recorded Citizen Kane off of PBS in the middle of the night afterwards, because I think that may have been the first time I heard about it. Because we've all sort of talked about this, but I think one of the things that Siskel and Ebert, one of their great gifts, was they were a gateway drug. Because to your point, Matt, you watched it and it turned you on to movies that you had never heard of. And I think the book communicates this really, really nicely, which is that I think people watched it because they liked the two of them and they'd heard of the big movies, but because they started to trust them and like them, they were then, viewers were susceptible then to, you should try with My Dinner with Andre. You should try Last Temptation of Christ. You should try these movies that maybe they wouldn't have tried otherwise. Like they turned me on to movies. They turned all three of us on to movies we wouldn't have seen otherwise. My last thing is, to this day, my only criticism of Apocalypse Now is it's not nearly as good as Ebert's written review for it, because I read it so many times before I ever saw the movie. No movie has ever been as magnificent as his review describing Apocalypse Now. So to the point about like what you lose in terms of like, I think Ebert's style was so incredible that he could make pictures in your mind in terms of his reviews. He was able to transcend those things. But I love your answer in terms of the Jonathan Rosenbaum thing. So I don't think there's a right answer to that in terms of his point, but it raises an interesting question, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, Rosenbaum's interviewed in Life Itself and uh-huh. Other places. And, you know, like he was friends with Ebert. It wasn't like he, you know, was like, these people, this is the death of film criticism. He was, you know, he is a smart guy. And he thought about these things really, really deeply. So, yeah, I'm not trying to slight him in any respect.
Oh, of course,
but yeah, I totally agree, you know, that I don't think this is in the book. This is something that from talking about the book so much that I've come to see, you know, like there are critics who are and writers, thinkers, whoever, you know, you can be a gateway or a gatekeeper, you know, that is an option available to everyone. And Siskel and Ebert, they were gateways. They were not gatekeepers. They liked welcoming you in. And I think part of the reason that so many young people were inspired by the show was that's how they approached it. Was they didn't say, well, you've never heard of Citizen Kane? What's wrong with you? Go do something else. They said, you've never heard of Citizen Kane? It's a masterpiece. Here's why you should go see it. Don't worry if it's in black and white. You're going to understand it and look for A, B, C, and D. And I did the same thing. And I think that was true of so many people who watched the show, is there's now this spiritual children of Siskel and Ebert generation that's out there, of people who their love of movies and criticism all comes from watching the show.
I love this idea of the gatekeeper versus the gateway, because I feel like depending on what video store you went to, you knew very quickly whether you had a gatekeeper. Okay, so my final question, this is actually kind of for both of you, because I always joke that I'm you know, when I do this podcast, I'm pretending to be a critic, and I'm definitely the Siskel in the while Ebert is going to the Gerson's going to all the film festivals, and I'm hoping Dream Scenario gets to Athens in time for us to be able to talk about it on the show and not making and thinking like, crap, let's just watch the Albert Brooks thing because it's going to be streamable in time for us to do it. Whereas Gerson has seen all this stuff weeks in advance. So you guys and both of you are more, Matt, I met you going to screenings in New York back when I was doing the Yahoo sites. I would run into you and I listened to the old IFC podcast and the old Films Playing SVU podcast. So you both of you have been doing this in a more serious professional way than I dabbling while writing about sports junk can do. And so I'm curious what really kind of for both of you about film criticism now. And I found myself, we keep having these stupid Martin Scorsese debates every single time a Martin Scorsese movie comes out. And there's all the dipshits arguing with Martin Scorsese. And I find myself constantly wishing I had Ebert's voice there. And it doesn't mean that I don't think there's not really, really smart people, including the two of you, writing about this, writing about these stupid debates and what Scorsese's doing and so on. But I find myself missing someone. To me, the two of you have that stature. To the world, not yet, but there's still time. There's no like, it's, to me, doesn't seem like a central, like the power of film criticism or a central voice of film criticism. Everything seems more diffuse now and everything seems more through that. And I'm curious about the profession, how you go about it. When Ebert would write something, he'd be like, people are going to listen to this. This is going to piss off Vincent Gallo. This is going to be a whole thing. And now I wonder, sometimes I love doing the show and I love writing about movies, but I still kind of feel like I'm spitting in the ocean sometimes. And I'm curious how you all kind of handle that in a world where not just film criticism has lost some cultural cachet, but many people, movies themselves have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, you're going to let me take this one, Tim? Thanks. Yeah. I appreciate that. That's very nice. That's very nice of you.
I'm happy to talk about one since you're our guest. I'd love to hear. I'm curious. I'm genuinely curious because I definitely have thoughts. I'm genuinely curious.
Right. I mean, yeah. I mean, anyone who is going, boy, I wish I had the audience of why don't I have the audience of Roger Ebert? God bless the person who has the confidence to think that. I certainly don't. I mean, I guess for me, one of the great things about writing this book, you know, there's been a lot of great things, but one of the gifts it's given me is that how many people want to talk about it with me, you know, readers and folks like yourself that, you know, we already established I'm watching this show as a 12-year-old in the dark in my bedroom. Alone. You guys at least were growing up with each other. I didn't have a Siskel and Ebert buddy. You know, like I had Seinfeld buddies that I would talk to about Seinfeld after the new episodes were on. I had Simpsons buddies. Later, I had film criticism nerd buddies, but that was later. That was like college. You know, this was like, I grew up thinking this was like this weird thing that only I liked. And you can say the world is much more diffuse now and it is. But what I have seen doing things like this and going to Columbus, Ohio, and talking to people is like, yeah, maybe the movies as a thing don't occupy the same space they always did. But people, there's so many people who still love movies and criticism and talking about movies, thinking about movies, talking about Siskel and Ebert. And like, I've talked to so many people who are like, I grew up in Billings, Montana. I grew up outside of St. Louis. I grew up in Pennsylvania. I grew up in this little town in Michigan. I'm not listing hypothetical examples. These are things that people have said to me specifically in the last couple of weeks. I grew up here and I loved this show and it made me want to be a movie critic or a filmmaker or a producer of film festivals, a programmer, whatever it might be. And it sort of made me like retroactively go, you know, I thought I was alone, but mm-hmm. I wasn't. And, you know, for all the dipshits, was that the word that we used? The dipshits? There are dipshits. Yeah. There's lots of dipshits. There are a lot of dipshits. But the internet has also connected a lot of the non-dipshits as well. And we can kind of communicate with the non-dipshits and talk about movies and read what everyone is watching on Letterboxd or on social media or following people on social media so that we know when Tim writes a new review that we want to read or whoever it is that you like or listen to their podcast or watch their YouTube channel, that you can get frustrated about, you know, the state of movies as a whole. You could say they're not as important as they were. TV has kind of supplanted them in some ways. And I don't think that's necessarily incorrect, but you can also see there's reasons to be excited or to be hopeful or to just be enjoy. Like you just look around and you see there are people out there who love movies just as passionately still, just as much as ever. And they have ways to watch them that they didn't have before. And they have ways to talk about them and communicate about them than they did before. I mean, when I was watching Siskel and Ebert, that was it. I was watching it. If I had wanted to write about these things, I could have wrote them down in a notebook, I suppose. Or maybe I could have got, like, if my middle school had a newspaper, maybe I could have, I don't know. I don't even know if they did. Now thank God Letterboxd did not exist, because those reviews would have to be scrubbed with the right. most powerful nuclear decontaminating shower to erase them from the internet. But now if I wanted to, and I was that age, I could have started writing wherever I wanted to. There's all these different outlets. I could have started a blog, a subset, whatever. And so, you know, you look for the silver lining and it is there. Is it a bummer that we don't have Roger Ebert or Gene Siskel around these days? Hell yes. And I mean, I would have loved to hear them about Killers of the Flower Moon or The Pigeon Tunnel. I would have loved the Siskel and Ebert podcast, not to knock your podcast, which I enjoy quite a bit, but can you imagine if they had been around to do the Siskel and Ebert podcast? I mean, it would have been the best. It would have been amazing.
We probably would not have bothered doing this.
No one would have bothered, probably, but it would have been great to listen to.
I mean, I know, I think you're pretty dead on, Matt, in terms of my own general feelings about this stuff. Another compliment to your book, Matt, that I really appreciated is that the book does not do, boy, you know, after Siskel and Ebert, film criticism has really kind of fallen off. It doesn't do that about movies either. I don't know. This is more rhetorical, but I don't know how much when you've talked to people about your book, if they say to you stuff like, oh, they don't make them like Siskel and Ebert anymore, because I like that your book doesn't make that argument.
Right.
Because my feeling for both films and film criticism is I tend to lose patience with people who will say to me, and it's kind of our age group that it starts to happen, maybe even a little bit younger, where they'll say, yeah, there just aren't as many good movies as there used to be. And that's more telling on themselves, because they have families, they have jobs, and that's not a knock on them because they have other responsibilities. But the idea that they're not paying attention to movies anymore, that doesn't mean there aren't still great movies out there. They just don't have that same cultural cachet. And likewise, I feel kind of the same way about criticism. There's no Siskel, there's no Ebert. By the way, Matt, one of the most interesting throwaway comments in your book is that the one person who said no to guest hosting was Manola Dargis, which is so perfectly Manola, because I could totally understand why she would not want to do that, because she is not somebody who likes to be in the public eye in that kind of way. But Manola is a giant. She is a massive, massive, amazing film critic, but she doesn't do those things. And so I think that speaks to just how diffuse film criticism is now. But one of the things that I enjoy is that, yes, none of us have the power of Siskel and Ebert, and no, the community is not maybe as strong. Journalism is not as strong as it was during the Siskel and Ebert days. But I feel like I have more friends to commiserate with now, because there are a lot of people kind of in the same boat, kind of trying to figure out these things. And I also feel like that's the community I share with in terms of people who like movies, that it is, because it's not the thing anymore in the culture, I think it attracts people who just really love the hell out of them now, because the people who love that, the people who love it will find other people who love it. Because to your point, Matt, when you were a kid, and to some degree, Will and I, because we were so lucky and we had each other growing up, it was like, you know, we were not the cool kids in our middle school and high school because we
No.
I don't like your tone, Singer. I don't like your tone.
Yeah. But we weren't, but we had each other. And Tim wasn't. To me, we'll fight about it on the next episode of the podcast. Tune in next time. But that was not a thing. And so I grew up with the idea that the thing I loved was not something that everybody else loved. And it was kind of fine because then it felt like it was mine.
Right.
And now it's really nice in my adult life. I'm so extraordinarily lucky that I get to do what I do. And I think, well, hell, somehow I managed to make that work and find other people who are kind of in that same world. And I feel like that world is bigger in some ways than maybe it would have been in the Siskel and Ebert days, just because there weren't as many people doing that. And so I find that part of the modern reality kind of comforting.
Yeah. And I, you know, to your point, you know, when people say, well, it's they don't make them like they used to, they would, people, that was the exact argument many people made about Siskel and Ebert in the days of Siskel and Ebert. This is not Pauline Kael and Andrew Saris. This is a desecration of film criticism. I mean, you know, we talked about Jonathan Rosenbaum, who I think was doing it in a much more serious and smart way. I'm not grouping him in there. But I mean, around that time, that's what people would say. This isn't film criticism. This is destroying film criticism. And here we're sitting saying, you know, this is the thing that inspired our love of film criticism. So to say, to turn around and say the same thing about today, like, oh, this isn't film criticism, I just think it is, yeah, kind of short-sighted. And, you know, you look at how Ebert, certainly in his final years, approached the internet and blogs and people who were writing online. You know, he was the most open-minded about that sort of thing. He was, again, gateway, not gatekeeper. He was not the person to be like, this isn't real film criticism. He would be like, look at what this person is doing, really interesting things on their blog. You should read it. And, you know, he was sharing that on Twitter at a time when he was one of the biggest people on Twitter, when Twitter was, you know, good, and we enjoyed being there. And that meant a lot when he would do that. So, yeah, I think, you know, look, is it a great time to make a living being a film critic? Nah, probably not. But is it a great time to be a consumer of film criticism in many different forms and many different outlets? I personally think yes, as a consumer of it. Yes, absolutely. There are more great places to read and listen to and watch than ever before, certainly in the days of Siskel and Ebert. So, yeah, I think you have to. Again, we've said it before on this conversation. These things are complicated. They're not simple, easy answers. And, you know, I mean, that's something that Siskel and Ebert gave us too. It was never, you know, even when people thought it was just two thumbs up or two thumbs down, anyone who watched the show would tell you that's not true. That's just what they would put on the marketing posters. If you watch the review, even if they gave it two thumbs up, they would disagree the entire review. It'd be 4 minutes of them arguing. And then at the end of the show, they would say, we both liked Wall Street. And then you watch the review and it's like, they don't agree on anything about that movie. They disagree about every single component and whether it's good or bad. They just happen to agree about the overall rating, you know? So that's, you know, these, that's how that, to me, that's part of the magic that we are here talking about.
Matt, the book, why don't you tell you the name of the book you wrote?
Yeah, what is this? This book sounds good. What is it called? I'd like to read it, I think.
It's called Opposable Thumbs, How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever by Matt Singer. Matt, I love the book. I'm really happy and proud for you on this. You did a great job with it. So thanks for coming on and chatting with us, and continue to now I look forward to in 20 years, you writing about Grierson Leitch. Get on it. We're available for interviews whenever you need us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay, good. Yeah. Thanks. Great.
Can I record? Do I get to record the audiobook of that one as well?
Incredible. Your audiobook is fantastic. The last thing is Tim has an interview, so I'm not going to go too long. But I will say that you did the audiobook for this, and you did a great job with it because I'm someone that goes back and forth sometimes because, you know, I'm driving a lot, and I would get to a certain point and I'd listen to it and I'd come back and read. And you are a good audiobook. I am not allowed to do audiobook for any of my books.
I still don't understand that.
It's fictional, so they're not like, Will, you don't get to do the 78-year-old black woman voice. You just don't. And I think that's fair.
Well, I didn't do voices. You don't have to do voices.
I know. Okay. I just trust professional actors and you, apparently, to be able to do audiobooks. So, but anyway, thank you, everyone. Buy the book. The book is terrific. Opposable Thumbs, How Sister Claire Changed Movies Forever. Matt, you did a great job. Congratulations on all of it. And I'll continue to, I'm looking forward to seeing the Marvels tonight so I can read your review and get you in the list.
Oh, yeah. That's one reason to be excited to see them.
Oh, no, don't spoil it. We're crying out loud.
Sorry. Spoiler alert.
Congrats,
thank you, guys.
Great job.
It was great talking to you guys. Thanks a lot.